Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a community credit union with 21 branches and a full suite of digital services. WSECU supports 9 regional farmers markets across Washington State and invites listeners to enjoy the bounty of summer at their local market. More information at WSECU.org.
So I'm actually going to, I have these machines on, and I'm going to run through and make one of these weapons for you so you can see the process. So I got all my different injection molds in here. These are some of the smaller ones that I've made.
Wait, before you go on, I just have to butt in and say, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. You're listening to Sound Effect, and I'm in Peyton Dean's garage right now.
Yeah, so this is just a basic two-part mold. So here you can see we have a Lego-scaled little knife there. And we've got a total of 14 cavities there.
Oh my gosh. So those are two metal halves.
Exactly.
And it's like, I don't know how you do, what size that would be. It's like,
it's about two and a half inches squared. 2.5, yeah. So I can actually run one here. So what we have going on here is currently this is at 440 degrees here. So we have the barrel. And right now I just put in some ABS plastic. So that'll come down here and melt towards the end there.
Those are like little beads?
Yeah, just little pellets you can buy off the shelf from, you know, industrial suppliers. And basically, we got the tool in here. This is all air-operated, so there's air pistons that operate this machine. And we have the mold sitting in here, and I'll hit these two buttons. This will clamp the mold shut so it doesn't open up, and it'll inject the plastic into the mold. So let's go ahead and do that. So we open this guy up. So there you can see we got 14 little knives there, and I'll just pop this out here. It's a little bit warm now, and then I'll just trim them off right there.
And now when you say little knives, explain exactly what they are for somebody who can't see them.
Yeah, so basically, if you guys know what Lego is, they have their classic little minifigures. They're about 2 inches tall, and they make them for Star Wars. They make them for, you know, Indiana Jones, all the classic movies, all that stuff like that. And what these are scale to that minifigure. So once again, pretty small, you know, maybe half inch tall, and they're combat knives from a video game. So that's one way that my customers can add detail to their minifigures is by buying these custom weapons that Lego themselves don't produce.
Peyton Dean started creating these custom Lego parts when he was 12. He got some help from his grandfather, a mechanical engineer. Peyton loved Lego, and he was into military stuff, and he wanted more tiny weapons for his sets, which Lego doesn't make.
So I was like, okay, let's figure out how I can do this myself. Once I figured that out, it took about 1 or 2 years. Then people started asking, you know, you should sell these, try making this one, make this one. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's some input and feedback coming back, so let's give it a shot. And sales kept going up, and it kind of just skyrocketed from there, so...
Well, your whole shop, you got what's the price tag on it?
That's a good question. I'd say with some of the machines I'll show you upstairs, it's pushing, I'd say $100,000.
That $100,000 worth of gear began with just $200 that Peyton had saved up. Today, he says he reinvests everything he makes back into the business.
I'd like to keep doing this, the Lego side of it, as long as possible. I could definitely take this full time if I really dumped a lot of time and effort into it.
What do your friends make of this? What do your peers make of this?
At first, people have that lack of belief in you, and then it kind of goes full circle, and they realize, like, hey, he's actually built something, and this is going somewhere for him.
And they see that you're making money.
Exactly. They definitely see that, so.
Well, Peyton Dean's the founder of X39 Brick Customs, and I'm standing here in his garage. Our theme today on our show is Cog in the Machine. We're going to be hearing about playing a role in things way bigger than ourselves, including the criminal justice system, the military-industrial complex. It's all coming at you here on Sound Effect from 88.5. Most of us don't grow up dreaming of being a tiny gear in some big, impersonal mechanism. But for Rich Hawkins, destiny started coming into focus on the day when, as a kid, the first family television showed up.
I was so kind of excited by the new TV set that I snuck out, and the living room was dark and everybody was watching, and I'm peering over the shoulder of adults on the couch, and they were watching a war movie. And I must have gotten scared, because the next thing I remember is being in my bed with the covers over my head, thinking how unfair it was that God had made me a boy, because I would have to grow up and do what I'd seen, the explosions and the mud and the pain and all.
The idea of war never excited Rich the way it might have for other boys, his friends playing army in the woods. To him, it just seemed like what boys did. Boys go off to combat. By the time he was in college, the Vietnam War had escalated. Rich opposed the war, but then he found out his student deferment was about to disappear, and he was left facing the draft. So instead, he decided to just enlist in hopes of getting a better job.
And I ended up as a, I guess they called it a combat correspondent, although it's a pretty glorified term. I was more like a public relations guy for the Army, but I was on the ground in Vietnam with the 1st Air Cav Division.
While Rich had gone through basic training, his role was supposed to be documenting the war, not fighting it. But around Thanksgiving in 1967, Rich found himself right in the middle of the storm.
One of the three battalions that I covered got moved quickly up into an area north of Con Tum. Dak To is the central village, where the 173rd Airborne Brigade had run into regular NVA forces. Big fight. And one of my battalions was called to support, and I heard about it, caught a plane up there, and managed to get out with one of the line units the day after they had tried to take a hill and had taken some casualties and fallen back. And they were going to go up again, and I was going to go with them. So I'd never experienced an airstrike before, and I wasn't really trained for a lot of things like that. And we crawled into an artillery shell crater for cover, and these two Navy Phantom jets appeared in the sky, and one of them peeled off and came zooming in overhead, and these big black eggs fell out of its wings and cracked into the ground about 500 yards up the hillside from us. And this incredible explosion. I'd never experienced anything like this. It was too loud. And then the shrapnel tearing off limbs of the trees overhead, and it was just left and right. The shock wave lifted me off the ground, maybe an umpteenth of a millimeter, but I lost all physical contact with the earth, which was my safety. Then the second plane comes in, and the second set of 500-pounders go sailing into the hill, and another blast. And then, this is what really surprised me. A sergeant down the line somewhere yells, "Move out!" And like every other GI on that hill, to my great surprise, I stood up and started walking up that hill with everybody else, prepared to live, to die. Or even, I don't know what I expected, but I didn't expect to ever do that. And I must have been afraid, although I wasn't aware of being afraid. I was just aware, really aware, because I left my body. It was like I was scared out of my skin, and I'm about 10 feet above myself, watching myself walk up the hill. And the thing that's probably most remarkable about this is that it was the most peaceful place I have ever been in my life, before or since. Absolute peace. That's what I experienced, and that's what I remember, is being outside my body and watching myself walk up that hill, and how peaceful that was. But I could see, I could imagine, I could think when I was there. I could see my body, imagine, I guess you could say, my body collapsing with my head falling off like one of those tree limbs had been severed earlier. And how that boy that I was, that young man, I should say, that soldier, was really someone who was against this war, thought it was stupid, And yet, the system works. It turned that kid into a young man who was a soldier, who was willing to kill or die for a cause he did not believe in. How amazing, how effective everything is. Be a good boy, say that Pledge of Allegiance, do all this stuff, and look what happens. Wow, isn't that remarkable how effective the system is? But somehow, suddenly I'm back in my body and tripping over fallen trees and whatnot and stumbling up the hill with everybody else. And the good news is the North Vietnamese had the sense to leave the hilltop during the night, and we never encountered any hostile fire. But I was scared out of my skin. And I've since thought that this was perhaps the most important thing that ever happened to me in my life.
When Rich had the realization of how the system works and how it had worked on him for a long time without him knowing it, his first reaction wasn't anger or resentment or shame, but wonder.
That was like amazement. Wow, this is look how effective this thing is, you know. I think I may have been angry deeply inside when I got out of the army. I didn't come home. I stayed in Europe and traveled around in Eastern Europe trying to understand the socialist world that had been my supposed enemy. The thing that I noticed early on was a lot of guys thought the war was really stupid, and you heard these comments about what a waste of time and energy and life and blood and resources this was to be in this war. But you never heard that in the frontline troops who were out there day after day looking for the enemy or knowing the enemy was looking for them. As soon as you got back from the line troops into the rear, you'd hear that. But you never heard anybody question the rightness of the war if they were out there risking their lives, obviously, moment to moment. And I wondered, why is that? My conclusion is that if you're putting your life on the line and willing to kill someone else, and that cause that you're doing it for is something you don't believe in, that's just too damaging to the self, to the idea of who you are. That's too hard to live with. At the time, you know, the term PTSD wasn't a big part of our vocabulary. But most of the GIs who died here at home. We had more deaths among Vietnam veterans from suicide and single car accidents and drug overdoses and all of that than there were killed in combat. If you're just playing your part in a big system, you know, you're just a cog in the machine. It's the machine's fault, not yours. But if you're out there, it's just too hard to live with that idea. I'm still ashamed that I let myself be part of that.
Rich Hawkins is a teacher and actor in Seattle. You're listening to Sound Effect on 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Cog in the Machine. You're about to meet a guy named Wolf, and we're using just his first name because, as you'll hear, anonymity is kind of part of the story. Wolf didn't want to be a father exactly, more like a middleman. He wanted to help bring a child into the world by being a kind of DNA dispenser. But as much as he wanted to be just a cog in the machine, he soon found himself tangled up in the human part of the process.
When I was 34, I was newly single again. And up until then, I had never really wanted children. I'd been very ambivalent about children. And then suddenly, now that I was newly single, I thought that I suddenly wanted them. I don't know where that came from. I just, it's like my clock went off with this huge clang, and suddenly wanting children was big. But now I was at an age where if I was going to meet somebody, the thought of trying to figure out if they were a good person to marry, and then marrying them, and then trying to have children, I figured would take me into my early 40s, because I move a little slowly. And I just didn't think that was going to work. And so I tried to find some solution to that. And I finally decided the best I was going to be able to do if I ever wanted a little biological piece of me to keep moving on was to become a sperm donor. It seemed like it was kind of a win-win. There would be a woman who in need who wanted something, and I had something to give, and we would both get what we wanted. So I went down to the clinic, and I was ready that day to make a contribution, but it turns out it's not that easy. This was more like trying out for NASA. They did extensive blood work. They looked at my family history going back multiple generations. They looked at any kind of genetic abnormalities I might. They had me on a treadmill jumping around. The process of getting sized up was very concerning. You know, if everyone gets judged. We're all judged here and there. But to be judged on who you actually are, what your actual genetics look like, is very different. So I was extremely concerned as to whether or not I would measure up. And when I found out that I did, that was relieving, but I still didn't know whether or not anyone would choose me, because what they do is you donate, and then they write up an anonymous donor profile for you. And prospective mothers go through, and they pick the person that they want. So even though I was genetically okay to go, I didn't know if my sperm would ever be used or just sit in cold, dark tubes for the end of days. After a few years, I went in to go see the director because I was curious whether or not anyone had actually selected me. So I went in, and I was not prepared for what he had to tell me. He let me know that I actually already had 10 children with 7 more on the way. It was one thing to know intellectually that this could be the case, but then to see it actually happening was staggering and surprising and humbling more than anything else, just honestly, very humbling in that perspective. After he told me that, he actually told me something else, which was even more shocking, which is that usually they preserve complete anonymity on both sides, but that a number of letters had actually come in for me offering to allow me to meet the child, which was just mind-blowingly kind of these folks. And they said that they had read it, and they had pulled out the one that they said, and I'm using quotes here, was the least crazy. And I just looked at that letter in his hand, and he handed it to me, and it seemed very heavy. And he said, here's the contact for someone in Seattle who is about to have your child, and you're welcome to contact her if you want. And we'll see how this goes. This wasn't something that I had envisioned myself doing, but it was so intriguing. I'd always wondered what it'd be like to watch a child of my own grow. And while I didn't make up my mind that quickly, I think there was no way I couldn't have walked through that door that had just opened. I wanted to keep that layer of anonymity intact. And in order to do that, I tried to think of, like, what would a spy do? Of course, I have no idea, but what I did is I actually made a fake Gmail address and made up a name, which was based on my donor name, and contacted the mother through that using my assumed name. That would be a good way of keeping up those barriers while allowing us both to get a chance to meet each other and talk. So next, we arranged a meeting in a neutral location. It's Seattle, so of course it was a Starbucks. And when I saw her come in carrying a small bundle, I was frightened and shocked and just really excited. I waved her down, she came over, we talked for a few moments, and then she handed me the child. And I was so nervous. This is something I'd been really wanting for 6 years, and suddenly here it was. And so I picked her up, and it was a baby. There wasn't that shock of recognition that I was expecting. It was just another child. The baby in this story, I'm calling Sarah. It's not her real name. And so then we sat down, and this was the mother's turn to grill me mercilessly about everything she wanted to know. She wanted to know what my favorite foods were, what I hated. She wanted to know what things I excelled at school and what I was weak at. Sports was very important to her. She wanted to know what I could play and what I just was never able to do. And when we were done, she actually offered to meet up with us once a quarter to watch the child as she grew. It seemed like an incredibly generous and kind offer. We began to check in quarterly, and it went well. She got larger, she became able to walk, she would trundle by. And I remember this one time, I think she was probably about 18 months, we went and we were at a small park, and she looked up at me, and she didn't have those small baby blue eyes anymore. She had my eyes. They weren't like my eyes. They were exactly the same shade, the same color. And it just took my breath away to realize that there was something else, some other part of me, someone else like me out there. A few months later, I actually came by. She was about two then. And I noticed that the neighbors were actually out front, and they were kind of like pointing at me when I was walking by, which seemed a little strange. And later on, I would realize that the mother had told the neighbors that Sarah's father was coming by. And that made me feel very uncomfortable, but I couldn't really put a name on it at the time. It was only after I got home and had given me some more thought that I realized what the discomfort was. And that was that I was really playing as a tourist in Sarah's life, that I was interacting with her on my terms, but I hadn't really thought about what effects that would have on her. At this point, she was only 2 years old and she didn't really seem to understand what was going on. But in a year or two, she would start asking some very difficult questions. She would ask, "Why does my daddy not live with us? Doesn't my daddy love me?" I just spent weeks thinking about this and trying to figure out how I could make it work, what I could do. Could I be that crazy uncle that just stops by once in a while? Well, she would find out when she was 18 that we'd been deceiving her all this time. That didn't seem healthy. Could I just get, you know, occasional email updates and pictures from the mom? Well, then she'd eventually find out that we'd been not letting her have this communication for all this time. And that just seemed like a betrayal as well. So I had to step away. I was just a donor. I realized that being a father means more than just looking out after your own good. It means doing what's best for your daughter, even if your daughter doesn't know who you are. Once I had made the decision, I called back the mother to kind of explain what was happening and let her know. And then I deleted the anonymous account that I'd been sending the email from, and that was it. This all happened a number of years ago, and since then, I still think about Sarah and her mother and her family, and I really hope that they're doing well. And I think about that day when she turns 18, and she will get my information, and I hope that she'll look me up. I hope she'll find me, and I'll get a chance to meet her and meet the person that she's become.
Wolf works in tech in Seattle. He's currently in a long-term relationship in which he's helping to raise his girlfriend's children. Our theme is Cog in the Machine today on Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Across the bay from Port Townsend is a narrow little hunk of land called Indian Island. It's a crucial component of that great big machine known as the Pacific Northwest Navy Fleet. Ships stop there to load up before heading out to the open ocean. But it's also hugely significant to another group of people, Puget Sound Area tribes. Like most things, it belonged to them before it became non-Indian property, but ever so slowly, Indian Island is beginning to open up to its original inhabitants. 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve went to the island to learn more of its complicated story.
My tour of Indian Island was not what I was expecting at all. It's so quiet and peaceful there, The place feels old. And I really got that feeling when we walked along the beach that was covered, seriously, covered in shells. You couldn't avoid stepping on them if you tried.
All along, that's all shell midden from hundreds of years of this being a fishing camp for the tribes.
That's Rocky Pulley. He's the commanding officer of Naval Magazine Indian Island.
And it goes down, you can dig down 10 feet.
The shells don't just go down 10 feet deep, they also go about 100 feet across this beach where we were standing. It's impressive and untouched. You kind of forget you're on a naval installation. But how exactly did it go from a tribal village to a military base? Well, look, you might not be all that surprised since the whole idea of tribes losing their land isn't exactly new, though in this case, it's a bit different. The military and native people are trying to forge a relationship where the parties involved have two very different interests, but it's a test to see if they can actually coexist on this little piece of land off the Washington coast.
But, you know, what an office, really.
You guys are a little spoiled here.
It doesn't suck to work here.
We'll get more into this relationship in just a bit. First, though, a brief history lesson. Indian Island is the ancestral home of the Chemicum tribe. Then it was later occupied by the Sklallams. Immigrants from Europe claimed parts of the land after the Sklallams signed a treaty in 1855 that forced them to relocate. Though the chief actually bought up about 15 acres himself to hold claim to the land. The last family to own parcels there sold it off in 1939 to the current owner, the Navy. The sale effectively cut off access to the tribes for most of the 20th century. Now, the installation was a big deal during World War II. Crews would load up ships heading to the Pacific while also guarding the Puget Sound region. It's still an important location for the Navy. It's the only deep water facility on the West Coast with no access restrictions like bridges or shallow water. And as you'd expect, Commander Pulley takes this history seriously.
The vast responsibility that I have as a commanding officer, not only to the 160 people that work on board this installation on a daily basis, but the history and the upkeep of the installation, the ground itself, it weighs on me. If I leave this installation and my impact is in a negative sense, I affect everything going forward.
Those 160 people do things like load and unload ships, fight fires, and do a lot of environmental work. You see, while the island itself is roughly 2,700 acres, the Navy only uses a sliver of the land, leaving the majority of the island largely untouched. The magazine's environmental manager is Bill Kalina. He explains that gives the island the feel of a wildlife refuge with deer, old growth trees, and 10 eagle nests.
We have large mature conifer trees that will support the weight of a nest. Some of the nests weigh 2 tons. So to find trees with the heavy limbs that will support the weight of that, it's pretty hard to find in areas that have been developed and clear cut or logged, you know, many times over.
But this is the place where the histories collide. There's the legacy of the native inhabitants, which stretches back centuries, and the mess left behind by its more recent tenants. We're standing in what used to be a huge landfill, but now it's covered in tall grass and dotted with trees. Kalina sweeps his arm to show a protected spot along the shore that has ties to the tribe.
This was the home of Lahaina, the Sklallam chief. He lived on this point, which is Boggy Spit, which was for thousands of years a fish camp. There's shell middens here, you know, there's artifacts that were recovered here over the years during excavations. So we bring some of these tribal youth groups down here from the Sklallam tribe. They come and visit this site to see where the chief, the prince, lived, Prince of Wales, and also go and look at the fish camp and explain why this was a fish camp. So they learn about their heritage and their history, and this was an important place for the Sklallams, and then prior to them, the Chimicums.
So what was once the chief's home became a landfill. And then Kalina and his team worked to restore it to what it once was. It's not perfect by any means, but they're making it work. The tribe's connection to this land runs deep. It's a food source, but also a place to harvest cedar and perform ceremonies. And as Laura Price explains, this island was considered to be in the heart of Sklallam territory. Price is the arts and cultural history director of the Port Gamble tribe, which is a band of the Sklallam people.
That's where the gatherings happened. That's where the ceremonies took place. When we had a big naming ceremony or some other important event, you know, people come from all over, but that was the central hub.
So this is about more than just accessing land. This is how the tribe is able to connect to and share its culture. And they weren't permitted to do that for a very long time. But then something changed a few decades ago. The thinking about treaty rights began evolving. And around that same time, the Navy started negotiating with the tribes to let the members onto the island for certain purposes. The initial agreement restored the tribe's treaty rights, harvesting naturally occurring shellfish. But the parties go back to the negotiating table every year. And as Commander Pulley explains, the talks have changed. They began to allow cedar harvests again. And last summer, tribal youth were able to land their canoes for the first time in more than 80 years.
So anytime that we can go out and improve those relationships and keep that culture going, you know, for the tribes, I'm all for it.
It's an unusual partnership. Kelly Sullivan, who's the executive director for the Port Gamble Sklallam tribe, says in a way, she's kind of glad it's the Navy they're working with.
If it weren't for the Navy, we could have 50 rich people living there and not have access to anything. These artifacts we find would be gone.
But of course, it cuts both ways. The same restrictions that protected the land from development have also kept the tribe out. And that leaves Sullivan feeling conflicted. Even though they can visit the island, it's still under lock and key. So much so that tribal members are required to go through intensive background checks in order to access the shores for fishing or harvesting every time they visit. They have to do itineraries, detailed lists. If you don't have an ID, it's a no-go. You can't get on the island. It's worth noting I did not have to go through a background check when I visited the island, and that actually caused a little tension. I requested that the tribal officials be allowed to join me for my tour of the island and was politely told no. Meanwhile, members of the tribe were harvesting cedar bark at the exact time I was on the island with the naval commander, but I wasn't allowed to meet with them. Instead, I spoke to Sullivan and Price later at the Port Gamble government campus in Kingston. But while the relationship can be frustrating, Price feels it's all worth it. She sees it as a way for her to honor her ancestors.
When I go to places that haven't been touched by our Sklallam people for a long time, I feel like we're letting our ancestors know that we have survived, that all their work and effort has paid off.
Price says it's this generation's way of saying we're still here. And Sullivan says yes, she knows that at the end of the day, the Navy owns the land, and they're doing the neighborly thing of sharing it with the tribe. Still.
Sometimes it feels a little bit like a losing battle when you're constantly fighting and you're constantly negotiating. Whether it's a good relationship or not, it eats at you and it wears at you and it never lets you rest.
So the Navy says this place is too important to let go, but it's also too important to the tribe to not fight for it. They haven't struck the perfect compromise yet, but both sides say they'll keep working at it.
That story from 88.5's Ariel Van Cleve. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today is Cog in the Machine. Time now for you to meet somebody.
My name is Kwesi Salih. Currently, I'm at Stafford Creek Correctional Center in Aberdeen, Washington. This is my 19th year of incarceration.
Kwesi says he finds himself behind bars in part because he was caught up in a great big machine, a system of poverty and racism that put him at a big disadvantage from the start. Kwesi came of age in Southern California in the 80s.
In the neighborhood that I grew up in, it was rough, so I end up falling into that trap, following my peers, being a follower throughout my life. A lot of destruction, a lot of violence, and a lot of drugs. I started selling drugs myself probably when I was 9 years old, carrying a firearm. You know, that's a part of my criminal history. and it was a way to survive.
Kwesi grew up in a kind of gang ecosystem. In his neighborhood, it was the rolling 60s. But depending on where you walked, you could quickly end up on somebody else's turf. Just going to the grocery store meant venturing into hostile territory. And that reality bled into everything, including who he looked up to and how he thought about his future.
When I was growing up, you know, we glorify the prison life, you know, older friends, older homeboys that were going to prison and coming out of prison. It was like a badge of honor to go to jail and to survive jail and to come back to the neighborhood and tell those stories that we lived in jail. So as far as when I was a child, growing up, you know, that was my future.
And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened. One day in 1998, Kwesi and a friend tried to carjack a couple for their Cadillac. A woman was shot and killed. Kwesi says it had only been a matter of time.
Having a gun was like a pair of pants you had on or your tennis shoes that you put on every day. For me, that's how it was. And so when you factor in drugs and guns and money, the potential of life loss is like a natural occurrence. And we didn't think about those things. I didn't think about those things. You know, we just act first, you know, like an impulse. And so I didn't think about how my actions could take another person's life. You know what I'm saying? You know, I live with that every day of my life now.
A jury found Kwesi guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced him to more than 50 years in prison.
I just had a little girl, you know what I'm saying? She was 1 year old when I got locked up. And so the hope of any type of relationship with her was, I knew, non-existent. I think that's the other part of the struggle that I had, not just the crime that I committed, but leaving a child, you know, to grow up without a father in her life, much like I did. You know, my father wasn't in my life. After a while, I realized that, you know, I was just repeating the cycle.
Kwesi's life in prison started out like a continuation of life on the streets. There was violence and retribution and the grind of daily life. It felt like being trapped in just another giant machine. It took almost 15 years for him to decide he didn't want to stay on that path.
I had got into a physical altercation. This one I was housed out of state in the state of Nevada. And I got sent to the SHU. And so that gave me, you know, that alone time, you know, all you have is time to think. And I realized that I had been in and out of the hole, not a lot, but enough to realize that what I was doing wasn't going to work if I had to spend this time in prison. And so I kind of made a conscious decision that that would be my last time going to the hole.
So Kwesi started to take steps, finding stability in education and religion. And then about a year ago, he discovered something called the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. It's a group of attorneys and judges, victims advocates, and citizens charged by the legislature to recommend reforms. And this all happened because of TVW. The Public Affairs Network is available in many of the state's prisons. It airs all the legislative proceedings in Olympia.
Most important for us is the clemency and pardons board hearings that they televise. And so every night before I go to bed, I would make sure I turn my TV to that channel. So that way, when I get up and turn the TV on, that's the first thing that I see in the morning. One day, I just happened to see a Sentencing Guidelines Commission meeting and listen to what they was talking about. I reached out to one of the commission members, and she encouraged me to make proposals so that, you know, our voice can be heard.
From behind bars, Kwesi went from watching the Sentencing Guideline Commission on TVW to actually being a participant. He's one of just a handful of inmates in the state to do that. He's giving the commission feedback on how proposed legislation having to do with the criminal justice system affects people like him, people who are in prison.
You know, one of the first pieces of work that I did was on the Second Chance Bill, trying to bring post-conviction relief, give individuals with long, determinate sentences like myself a chance to re-enter society, those of us that have grown in prison. And it's not just about relieving the punishment or anything like that, but it's true reform where, you know, everybody has a stake in it.
you know, everybody has a stake in it.
Kwesi's not pushing to simply throw open the doors, but he wants more flexibility for the justice system to adjust punishments on an individual basis, to make better decisions about who needs to stay behind bars and who could be safely released. In his own way, Kwesi is working within that machine to introduce a little more humanity. You're tuned to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this last story of Cogs in the Machine revolves around a mysterious poem from Taiwan. It was eventually discovered halfway around the world by Sound Effect contributor Joel Shupak. When Joel found that poem, he was working a tedious warehouse job in Bend, Oregon. This little bit of foreign text broke Joel out of his dull routine, and it became kind of a guiding light that he's held on to ever since, even though it didn't turn out to be exactly what he thought.
I found the poem on the inside of a thin cardboard box. It was written by hand in black pen. My job was to open boxes full of sunglasses, take them all out, and put each pair into a separate box. They would be mailed out to all of the dupes who signed up for the Sunglasses of the Month Club. It was one of these scammy companies that would mail out leaflets advertising free sunglasses, $40 value. An asterisk would direct you to the fact that you only had to pay shipping and handling, a mere $19.95. I was the handling. I was 19 years old, out of money, and living with my parents. I found the job through a temp agency. "Have you ever thought about production work?" they asked me. Production work? I imagined a film set. "Sure," I said. The number of sunglasses I handled on a daily basis was dizzying. Each pair was wrapped in plastic that seemed to crinkle more than it should. And each came with a tiny round sticker that said, "Made in Taiwan." We were instructed to remove the stickers. Each of us in the warehouse had one task. To my right, a woman folded small boxes. I placed the sunglasses inside. To my left, another woman slapped on a packing label. And who were all of these people who would wear them? I imagined them being tried on in rearview mirrors or dangling off the chests of muscle shirts. Each box was a person who lived and dreamed and wore tacky sunglasses. And every week, more shipments arrived. Then, one afternoon, deep in the drowsy zombie rhythm of the production line, I pulled out a handful of sunglasses, and on the inside of the box was something new. 6 lines of Asian characters, handwritten. I ran my finger over the indent left by the pen. Each character was an intricate and exotic thing. Here was the mark of someone halfway around the world whose hand placed the sunglasses that mine removed. Maybe someone just like me, young and lost, and sick to death of sunglasses. I tore the bottom from the box and stuffed the scrap of cardboard into my pocket. Somewhere else, far from these warehouse walls, was a wide and magical world. And these words I found, whatever they meant, were like a crack that let me see out. I kept the slip of cardboard in a box of keepsakes and old journals. It was out of sight, but the feeling I had simmered. I needed to leave. And at the end of that summer, I packed up a car to move to New York City. In that packing, I found the poem again and wanted to know what it said. I put a post on Craigslist looking for a translator. I was amazed how quickly someone responded. She told me it was a small love poem. "Don't want to. I don't want to grow up," the poem began. "I will lose her if I grow up. Why can't I find the innocent rose? Aurora. Pandora. If you pick me, that's your luck. Don't you know?" To be honest, I wasn't even sure if I liked the poem. Why is everyone always so obsessed with an innocent rose anyway? Still, I wondered, did she pick him? Where was he now? Out of the factory, I hoped. I wondered, if anyone was going to pick me. In New York, I kept the poem on my wall in this tiny apartment I shared with punk rockers. I even tried to be one of them. But a year later, exhausted from the city, I left. I followed a woman to California. There, I tried to be a farmer. I brought the poem along. When we split up after a few years, I moved to Portland to be a folk singer. I put the poem on a sort of altar, and it's been there ever since. And now, I'm packing up my life again to follow another dream, this time to make radio stories in another country. The poem, of course, is in my suitcase. Before leaving, I wanted to see if there was anything else I could learn about it.
为什么找不到无邪的玫瑰花？不想长大。
So this is William Ma, a friend of a friend who was happy to read it and give me a second opinion on the translation.
So I sent you this poem that I found. What can you tell me about it?
So first of all, I don't think it's a sort of formal poem. The lines themselves, although they were somewhat poetic, they seem more like song lyrics to me. So I just did a quick Google search, and I discovered the first four lines, I guess. They come from a song.
This is when I realized that the poem was not at all what I thought. The first few lines are lyrics from a band called SHE. They were these huge Taiwanese pop stars 12 years ago. I always assumed the writer was a young man, like me. But William says it's probably a teenage girl. Most of their fans were. The next two lines, Aurora, Pandora.
It turned out to be song titles by another Taiwanese pop singer, Angela Jang.
So most of what I found was just copied down pop lyrics. But the final line.
If you pick me, that's your luck, don't you know?
William couldn't find that anywhere. It seems like whoever wrote it came up with it herself. This poem has watched me follow dreams and abandon dreams, fall in love and out of love. 12 years I've held on to it and looked to its cryptic words for guidance and wondered about the person who wrote it. We all need something to believe in, even if it's mostly nonsense. But I do know that somewhere far away is a young woman, though not so young anymore, who once scribbled some lines on a box in a factory. It was just a little diversion from a tedious job, something to do with her fingers, besides placing sunglasses in a box for me, an ocean away, to find.
That was producer Joel Shupak. He's now working in Jerusalem as the production intern with the podcast Israel Story. That wraps up another edition of Sound Effect. Our show is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Janae Janik. We had help this week from Monica Spain, Ariel Van Cleve, Joel Shupak, Paul Currington, and Kim Gordon. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Come on back next week when our theme will be Upside of the Down. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.